After Dr. Sims leads us in an opening hymn, Craig Sider will lead us in prayer. Craig is a member of the Brethren in Christ denomination, as is Dr. Gish.
Our God is truly with us this morning, and he challenges us to pray that he would be with us in the future. We're going to sing this morning a hymn of our faith, number 28, O God, our help in ages past, our hope for years to come, 28.
Let's pray together. Father, as we come into your presence this morning, we want to remember who you really are, that you are God, that you are holy other, with majesty and power and glory. And may we always have that sense of awe of who you are. But we do thank you that we can call you Father this morning, and that we are a redeemed people because of your revelation through Jesus Christ. And we are heirs of the promise, members of an inheritance. And together we are brothers and sisters in Jesus Christ. And may we never forget that this morning. We are a community with needs this morning. There are people among us who hurt physically or spiritually or mentally. And we lift those needs to you this morning and ask that you meet them in a very special way. And especially for this hour as we gather together, you have promised your Spirit to us. But may we be sensitive to it this morning. May our minds be alert. May we be receptive to what truth you would have to say to us. And may it not only stay with us here, but may our lives be changed as we go out and minister to people. We ask for a special anointing of your speaker for the truth that you have given to her. And ask that as she gives it, we be receptive people to your truth. For we ask it in and through Jesus Christ. Amen. You may be seated.
I'm very proud to have been given the privilege to introduce Dr. Gish yesterday and to have been given the privilege of nominating her for the Ryan Lectures this year. And glad that she accepted the opportunity to spend even 2 days in Kentucky, which is difficult for people from central Pennsylvania. When I moved here from central Pennsylvania myself, one of the kind ladies in the area took us out to dinner, and she said, Harold, I really do not know how you could stand to move from central Pennsylvania to Kentucky. And then everything got very quiet, and she said, tell me, is it actually possible to buy good things to eat in Kentucky? People like nice things in central Pennsylvania, and food and ice cream and all of those kinds of things, and we've chatted with Dorothy about that, and I have good memories of there, but I am glad to be here at Asbury. And I'm glad to have Dorothy spend at least these few hours of her life on this campus. I think it will be good for her. Now, she has given me a task that I do not know whether I'm up to. There is a pile of overhead things, and if I get mixed up and ruin her lecture by getting the wrong slide on, please forgive me. I'm going to try to stay with Dr. Gish as she shares with us her understanding of ministry to the aging.
Thank you. After his introduction yesterday, you'll know why he's gotten the task of working the overhead. Last year at Messiah College, the chapel sessions dealt with how to deal with difficulties in the Christian life. And they asked me to do the session on dealing with failure. And I thought about that, and I thought, I wonder why they've asked me to do that. And then as I thought about it, I realized that most of my speaking and lecturing in the last couple of years has dealt with singleness, stress, particularly among missionaries, and aging. And I thought, aha, that's the reason. Talking about talking about singles in a paired world, talking about stress among the bearers of good news, and talking about aging in a youth culture. No wonder they think I know how to deal with failure. Well, I'm very happy this morning to be able to share with you about ministering to the aging, because I think it's a very important thing to consider. I suspect that one of the places we need to start is by asking the question, who are the elderly? Because in this day and age, people are living longer and they're more vigorous, so who are the elderly, I think, is an important question to ask. The first cartoon probably helps us to see this, where the little tyke... I do that all the time. I'm glad to know somebody else does it. The little tyke looks at the school-agers and thinks they're old, and the kid looks at his parents, and then later on, as he becomes older, you want to just pull it down. You know, finally, you know, we keep moving on to thinking everybody's old. Well, I suspect that the best definition, really, I think the best definition I've heard of what is old is anyone who's old, anyone who's 5 years older than I am. And I think this cartoon portrays that well. Actually, you know, interestingly enough, in the literature now, we are seeing terms like young old and old old. And if you explore what that means, generally what they mean is when they talk about the young old, they're basically talking about people from somewhere around 60 to about 75. The old old usually means 75 or 80 and above. Do you know that in the United States today, 11.5% of our population is over 65? I think it's interesting, though, that if you look at the 1980 census, according to the 1980 census, that was 4 years ago, I'm sure it would be more now, but according to the 1980 census, there were 32,194 people over 100 years old in America. 32,194. Do you know that in the United States today, we have 10% of all the world's old people, even though we have only 5% of the world's population? So that I think we're talking about a significant part of our population. And it seems appropriate to me then that we talk about how can we minister to that population. I think probably the best way to go is to begin by considering a biblical perspective of aging. And so that's the first point I want to deal with. What does the Bible have to say about aging? Basically, a good bit more than I thought it did. As a matter of fact, The next overhead shows some of the Bible verses that deal specifically, and this is not in any sense exhaustive, and I don't mean to proof text, but I do think it's interesting that there are at least several major points that I think the Bible makes about aging. The first one is that the aging are portrayed... There we go. Yeah. The aging are, that's my fault, I had them in the wrong order. The aging are portrayed as having beauty and wisdom, according to Proverbs 16:31, Proverbs 20:29, and Job 12:12. I had those put on overhead because I figured some of you wanted to copy them and you couldn't copy them from my walking through them. There's another section of verses that indicates that the aged are given special roles. That's Psalm 71:14-19, and also Psalms 92:12-15, Joel 2:28, Acts 2:14-21, 1 Timothy 5:17, and Titus 2:1-5. There are also a set of verses that suggest that for those who walk in the paths of righteousness as they age, that is, for the godly as they age, aging is a time of special rewards and a time of gifts of renewal. And those verses are in Psalms 37:25-26, Psalms 90:14-27, Psalm 91:14-26, Psalm 103:1-5, and also verses 17-18, and Isaiah 46:3-4. There's another very interesting verse. The whole concept of respecting elderly people is gained from a number of places, but there's a verse in Leviticus 19:32 that particularly admonishes that older people are to be respected. Of course, there are quite a number of verses talking about respecting and caring for one's parents, and I have not included those. It's interesting to me also that there's another set of verses that indicates the importance of preparing for your old age. Those are the kinds of verses that you find in Psalms 90:12, or Proverbs 3:1-2, Proverbs 9:10-12, Proverbs 22:6, Ecclesiastes 12, 1 to 8 and 13 to 14, and 1 Peter 3, 9 to 12. Now, there are other verses and other things about aging, but basically I think I could summarize it by saying if you look clearly at what the Bible says about aging, it's basically a positive view. That's in great contrast to what is our American society's view of aging. The Bible portraying aging as a time of wisdom, a time of beauty, a time of special renewal. How does our society look at it? Well, I think our society, the American society view of the age, is clearly a youth-oriented. We are clearly a youth-oriented society, and we tend to look at it from that perspective. To be young is to be in. To be old is to be over the hill. One's 30th birthday is a traumatic event. You know, I am currently working with a professional young woman who was so traumatized by her 27th birthday she couldn't get out of bed. Now, that's sad, and yet here's a Christian young woman who feels like that. Last year, I was in California visiting a mental health institution, and I was shown to the office of their lawyer, and I was amazed because there was a big bunch of black balloons in the corner. There were black streamers hanging from the light. There was a black bow on his coffee cup. And when I inquired as to what tragedy had occurred, I was informed that it was his 40th birthday. Now, that's not at all unusual to find those kinds of things. Or as this cartoon puts it, our view of aging is really that it's bag city in Wrinklesville. Old bag country, sag, wrinkle city over the hill, age 40. You know, that's a typical kind of view of our society about aging. And I think we need to realize that what happens is that in our society, your importance, your value is often measured by your economic productivity, your material possessions, how much money you have, how much power you have. And so when one becomes only a consumer and no longer a producer, then your value decreases. We are certainly a society that engages in planned obsolescence in many ways. In the next cartoon, I think the lady says it well. She says they're planning to junk us too. And that's the feeling you get many times from our society. I think at least part of this negative attitude can be traced to a number of myths that we have about aging. And so I'd like to consider with you, what are some of the current myths on aging that I think are very prevalent in our society today? The first one of those myths is the idea that aging is a disease. Now, I would like to tell you that aging is not a disease. Senility is a disease. Aging is a natural result of living. Senility is a disease. Senescence, which is the professional term for aging, is not. It's a natural result of living. It begins at conception and continues till death. There have been at least five, I think, major causes of senility that have been identified. You know, not all old people, you don't automatically become senile as a result of being old. Senility is a disease, and it's due to we've identified at least five major sources. One of them, of course, is Alzheimer's disease that's getting more and more attention lately. Another one is hydrocephalus, which is excessive cerebrospinal fluid on the brain, and it tends to be more common in older people. A third cause is poor brain nutrition, particularly a lack of sufficient blood and oxygen to the brain. I heard an older man talking to a group of older people about this, and he concluded, I thought this was great, his conclusion was, so folks, learn to take deep breaths and breathe well and deeply now. Gland malfunction, particularly the thyroid gland, is another common cause of senility in older people. And depression. What often comes across as senility is really a result of depression. Well, those are at least five causes that are five of the things that cause senility. But I think if you talk to many people out there in the world at large, you sort of get the feeling that senility is a natural result of aging. And so what happens is when people have a condition that could be reversible, we think, well, they're just getting old and senile, and so we sort of pack them off and expect them to be senile. Take, for example, the example of an older person who's fallen and broken a hip or had a heart attack, and so they're taken to the hospital, and perhaps as a result of the shock or as a side effect of the drugs that they're being used to treat, or even just as a result of the strangeness of the hospital routine, the person becomes confused. What happens? Very often that condition is reversible, but the family and perhaps even the physician mistake it as the beginning of senility, and so they pack them off to a nursing home somewhere. My point is that being forgetful is a normal part of life. And young people forget things too. Just last week, I sat down at the in our dining hall next to a bright young freshman, and we were talking, and she was thoroughly frustrated because she could not remember the name of a person that she'd worked with all that summer. Now, you know, we sort of forget those things. Now, if that had been an older person, they would have said, well, I'm just getting so forgetful I can't remember things. The point is that we expect older people to be forgetful, and so we notice and exaggerate that. And older people, just like people of any age, have a way of living up to our expectations. Well, basically, I'm trying to say senility is a disease, aging is not. A second myth is that aging means unproductivity. Part of the problem here, I think, is we define being productive as being employed in something you're getting paid for. And that's why housewives and older people in our society see themselves as less important than they really are, because they're not doing something they're getting paid for. I would like to suggest to you that older people have a lot to offer, even if they are not gainfully employed. In other days, and even now in societies other than our own, older people are a valued part of the society. And I'm concerned because when I think about how much the church is losing because its older members are not valued and used to their fullest advantage. Do you know that all except two of the U.S. presidents this century have been over 50? At 93, George Bernard Shaw wrote Far-Fetched Fables, and Frank Lloyd Wright designed the famous Guggenheimer Museum when he was 90. I'm sure you've all heard of Grandma Moses, who began painting later in life and was still doing so when she was 100. So aging does not necessarily mean unproductivity unless you have a narrow definition of productivity. A third myth is that old people disengage from society. The theory of disengagement basically says that as people age, they gradually withdraw from activities and positions. And what they really want is to be left alone in peace and quiet and have the younger people carry the responsibilities that they've shouldered long enough. However, I think that most healthy old people really don't want to sit back and take it easy. I think disengagement is a myth, because I think what happens is we subtly and slowly and systematically take away powerful roles from the older people, and then we say that they are disengaging. The next cartoon, I think, puts it very well, because instead of the older people being disengaged, it has society kicking them out the door, and they are saying who's disengaging whom. I think disengagement theory has been perpetuated because it happens to fit into our society. We want older people to disengage, and we help them do it, and then we turn around and say that that's what they're doing. The rocking chair syndrome is often portrayed by older people because they feel that's what is expected of them. And when younger people perceive older people as old and worn out, that's the way they're going to relate to them. Well, so much for that myth. A fourth myth is the myth that old people are inflexible. Now, I suspect that the reason older people sometimes appear inflexible is that we have stripped them of so much power that they tend to cling rigidly to what little they have left. However, if you look at the whole picture and you realize that older people often have to solve complex personal problems with far fewer resources, whether that's money or a job or strength or whatever it is, with far fewer resources than they had when they were younger, if you look at it in that light, you have to marvel at how well they manage. In fact, looked at it that way, you begin to realize that older people are really more innovative than younger people, many of whom would be overwhelmed by the problems that are a steady diet of the older person. There's also some evidence that older people are able to bring to mind and entertain many different facets of information. And this shows up when they talk, because they can wax eloquent with a rich, evocative fluency that enables them to say the same thing in five different ways, in a way that a younger person can't begin to match. So basically what I'm saying is that older people are not inflexible. And I think we need to realize that those younger adults who are able to tolerate ambiguity, who enjoy new experiences, those are the people who are more likely to be flexible in their older years and also to attain their mental alertness. My grandmother died 3 years ago at age 98. She was a marvelous lady. She took her first snowmobile ride when she was 84. Now, it's openness to new kinds of experiences. You don't develop that at age 80. You grow into that as you go along. Okay, another major myth that I think is the myth that old people are asexual. They're no longer sexual human beings. I think that attitude is conveyed very well in the fact that if you have a man of 30 who's in the hospital and he makes a pass at a nurse, he's regarded as normal. You have a 70-year-old man in the hospital who makes a pass at the nurse and he's called a dirty old man. You know, it clearly says that we no longer see older people as sexual. It is true that sexual interest does diminish somewhat with age, but it doesn't disappear. There is a slowing down process and sexual performance takes longer, but the general pattern seems to be that those who are sexually active in their middle years maintain that activity well into their 80s if they're physically healthy. There was an interesting longitudinal study that was done of men and women aged 45 to 70. And you know that 20 to 25% of those men and a small percent of the women were found to have increasing incidences of sexual activity as they grew older. I think we need to remind ourselves that those figures are based on people who were old a couple years ago, not the young people now who are aging. A study that was done in 1981 studying 800 people age 60 to 91 found that about 36% said that sex was better now than when they were younger. That's over a third of them. And about 80% were sexually active on a weekly basis. But, you know, I think we need to realize that older human beings are still whole human beings, and that includes sexuality. A sixth myth is the myth that old people find it difficult to learn. Now, for years, we had research that seemed to support that. We had research that seemed to say after 30, it was pretty much over and it was downhill, that intelligence declined with age. Basically, that research was based on cross-sectional research, and apparently what was happening is they were measuring cohort differences rather than real intelligence. More recently now, we have some good longitudinal research. Longitudinal research is research that takes the same people and follows them over time. We have longitudinal research that shows that among people who remain emotionally and physically healthy, and in this case, they're defining physical health as a lack of diseases that affect the brain, like stroke or Alzheimer's. People who remain emotionally and physically healthy, that their intellectual growth continues well into the 80s. This is particularly true of what we refer to as crystallized intelligence. Crystallized intelligence is that ability to use an accumulated body of information to solve problems. It's what we commonly call wisdom. And we find that, in fact, John Horn at the University of Denver has done a lot of research on this, and he finds that crystallized intelligence continues to increase steadily throughout life. Although in old age, the increments are smaller. That is, the increases are not as large, but it does continue to increase. The deficits that occur in healthy older people are really in the more nuisance range, particularly in the short-term memory range. It's harder to remember names and phone numbers than it used to be. But I'm concerned because I think countless intellectually vigorous lives have been atrophied on the mistaken assumption that old age brings unavoidable mental deterioration. Again, that the expectation of a mental decline is a self-fulfilling prophecy. Somebody put it this way: after all, the brain is a muscle. And like any muscle, you use it or lose it. Okay? A seventh myth is that all old people are alike. Given any group of people, the time they are most alike is at birth. Because from that moment on, their experience begins to diverge so that the older they are, the more different they are. Human personality is unique. And later in life, when personality reaches its fullest development, we see those differences more clearly. So that I think we need to remind ourselves that not all older people are alike. And also we need to remind ourselves that aging is not a single process, but it's many processes, and it begins at different ages for different people. Chronological age is a very poor indicator of age, of the kind of aging that an individual may be experiencing. In fact, you know as well as I do that some people are old at 30 and other people are young at 70. I think the very interesting, I heard somebody ask a very interesting question that I think it might well be worth our pondering, and that is, how old would you be if you didn't know how old you was? Well, having debunked some of those myths about aging, let me go on then and look at what are some of the real needs of the aging. What is some of the reality that exists? Well, I think one of the real needs of the aging is clearly that of adjusting to the loss of significant roles. You know, children and the aged do share a common characteristic, and that is a lack of power in society. Children grow into power, but for the elderly, we take away from them the power that they once had. And we say, now you got to learn to be content without it. Retirement for many people brings the loss of the significant role of worker and wage earner. And you know, how a person retires has a profound effect on that person's reaction to retirement. Those who retire due to ill health usually don't enjoy retirement. Those who are forced to retire are not nearly as satisfied as those who retire voluntarily. I think, too, when we're talking about the loss of significant roles, we need to recognize that for many people, that often includes the death of a marriage partner. And so it results in the loss of the role of spouse. Now, widowhood is certainly an undesired and often an unanticipated change. And it has very immediate negative physical and emotional effects on the surviving spouse. I think perhaps loneliness is one of the most pervasive problems for older people who are suffering the loss of this role. And also for widows, it is often compounded by economic problems. But clearly older people are adjusting to the loss of a number of significant roles. Secondly, one of the real needs for the aging is that of developing a satisfying use of time. When time constraints and responsibilities imposed by the work world are removed, some people find a new freedom to expand that energy in more rewarding pursuits. But some people find it a very severe loss, and they have difficulty envisaging new horizons or new uses for their time. What I'm saying is that the end of a regular work life, retirement if you like, means a great deal more freedom for many people. But many older people have untapped interest and latent abilities, and they don't know how to go about begin developing them, and they often need help in doing that. I think we need to remind ourselves, too, as a person gets older, the mundane activities of life such as personal care, housekeeping, tinkering, puttering, those activities assume far greater importance because they represent one's continued ability to be independent and to take care of oneself, whereas earlier you used to just take doing those things for granted. However, I think we need to remind ourselves that many vital adults are not satisfied with just busy work. They need to find meaningful ways to keep active and creative. Well, a third need, in addition to adjusting to the loss of roles, in addition to developing a satisfying use of time, the third need is adjusting to what I refer to as the physical 3S downgrade. You know, these hills that go down like this. Aging means that you have to, first of all, adjust to declining physical strength. So that's the first S. What one did easily and without thinking or effort now takes lots of both. The steps to climb, the heavy doors to open, those can become real barriers. Painful joints, less grip strength make it difficult to open pill bottles and containers. Not only is there a decline in physical strength, but there's also a decline in sensory perception. Do you know, I have just recently, within the last year, become aware of the diabolical plot of many manufacturers to make the print on things I buy so small that I can't possibly read it. Also, when I teach a class in gerontology and we talk about the sensory decline, the decline in sensory perception, hearing, taste, sight, touch, smell, many students find it hard to identify with that. Until we begin to talk about the fact that hearing begins to decline starting at age 20. Then suddenly I have all of their attention. Not only does physical strength decline and sensory perception decline, but you also have a decline in speed of response. It takes longer to get your body mobilized to respond. So that makes driving more hazardous, or slippery floors or other small things that one hardly noticed before now can become a real jeopardy. So there are some decrements that do need to be adjusted to. A fourth real need of older people is adjusting to psychosocial changes. You know, the older one gets, the more friends, the more loved ones, the more cohorts one is likely to lose. The mother of one of my colleagues is now 102 years old. She's an exciting lady. She lives in a retirement village not far from me. And every year she's gone back to her home congregation some 50 miles away for what they refer to as their over 65 weekend. Last year somebody asked her about it, was she planning to go, and she said, no, I don't think I'm going to go. And as she talked on, the reason she was not going to go was because even the third generation of people that she had made friends with had now died off. She'd outlived three generations. You know, that's a real problem. Also, independence and personal effectiveness are very important because they form the foundation of an older person's identity. And so for older adults, the main issue is to avoid losing your independence and your personal effectiveness, to avoid having your resources drop below the level that's required for self-reliance. Personal effectiveness, by the way, is that sense that you have the capacity to control your own destiny. You have the capacity to make decisions about you that are going to affect you. Another thing that, in terms of psychosocial changes, that often happens is what we refer to as the life review. Older people talking about the past. Don't make fun of that, because the life review is a very important part of a very important way of coming to grips with aging. Not only that, but young people can learn a lot from it if they take the time to. I think perhaps one of the reasons many older people talk so much about the past is due to the fact that they now have so little power left that they prefer to think about the time when they were more powerful and more rigorous. Let's not take that away from them. A fifth need is the need for coping with reduced income. 16% of all older people in the United States are living at the poverty level, and about 40% are close to that. So you have about 50% that are at poverty or close to poverty level. I think we need to remind ourselves that nearly one-third of those people have been poor all of their lives. Another group are probably at that level now because they lost their job after age 45 and found it difficult or impossible to get another job. But poverty is a real fact of life for some older people. It's much more likely to occur, by the way, among single older adults. Particularly currently, the greatest population at jeopardy among older adults are single older women. But even for the average person, retirement brings about a 40% decrease in income. Now, that's usually expected and adjusted to, but sometimes it means profound lifestyle changes. Then, too, the longer a person lives, the more precarious their finances become, especially in our day and age with increasing inflation. And so persistent worry and anxiety about financial matters can be a real drain to many older people. I think we also need to remind ourselves that reciprocity is important. It's just as important to older people as it is to younger people. What I'm saying is older people need to feel like they're giving as well as receiving. And for some people who have made giving to the Lord's work a very important part of their lives, it is embarrassing now to them to have to reduce their giving, particularly for many people at a time when their churches have increased pressure for giving because they have to meet increased budgets. So I think we need to realize that and realize how our increased talking about giving might affect some older people. Okay, another area that we need to, is a real need, is maintaining satisfactory living arrangements. About a third of all elderly people are widowed. The majority of the remaining two-thirds live with their spouses. Most older people prefer to live in an independent household. And for many, I think that's a realistic expectation, especially if they have in-home service available. Here again is an area where I think the church could help by providing some services to allow people to remain independently in their own homes as long as they can. About 14% of older people live in the home of a child, and about 4 to 5% in institutions. Now, for those who choose it and can afford it, retirement villages seem to be a good answer, but not everybody can afford it. The important thing, I think, is that the person involved feels like they have the power to decide where they're going to live and how they're going to meet the needs for satisfactory living arrangements. In a very interesting study they did a number of years ago, they interviewed a group of widows who were just going into a nursing home. I think it was a retirement village and nursing home together, but they were just entering. And as they interviewed this group of widows, they basically found that they fell in two categories. One group that said, I could have done this, I could have done that, but I've chosen to come here. This was my best option. There was another group of widows that says, I don't really want to be here, but it's the only thing I can do. The thing that fascinates me is within a year, about 75% of that group that said, this is the only thing I can do, were dead. Very few of the other group had died. So the importance of feeling like you can make a decision is very important. Okay, another important part of meeting the needs of older people is coming to terms with death. You know, 2/3 of all deaths in the United States today are to people over 65. And cardiovascular disease and cancer account for about 80% of those deaths. Do you know that in the States today, the group with the highest suicide rate is older white males? I think that says something about what we're doing to older people. The probability of facing death obviously becomes higher each year that one ages. But for many older people, the increasing proximity of death really doesn't produce a lot of fear. And generally what we find is those people who are religious and have a real purpose in life seem to fear death less than those whose life really has no meaning and have no faith. But on the whole, I would say it's probably safe to say that while older people need to come to terms with approaching death, they tend to be less fearful of death than younger people are. The one thing that is the prime fear of many, many older people is poor health and disability, not being able to care for yourself, being dependent on someone else. Well, I considered some of the myths of aging, some of the real needs of aging. I want to close by asking the question, how can we minister to the elderly? Given all of this, we've considered who the elderly are, what are some of the myths, what are some of their needs. What can we now do to teach? What can we now do to minister to these elderly? Well, some of the things I've already implied. For example, the first thing I'm going to suggest is I think we need to teach, not only to the older people, but to our congregations at large, we need to teach a biblical perspective of aging. We need to look more clearly than I have done at what does it mean to age from a biblical perspective? What does the Bible have to say about it? Younger people need this to give them a proper perspective, and older people need it to give them a sense of self-esteem. But I think we need to realize as we do that, that it's going to fly in the face of our culture's view of aging, and we need to deal with that. But I think some clear-cut teaching about aging from a biblical perspective is one of the ways we can minister, not only to the elderly, but to our whole congregation. Secondly, I would hope, one of the reasons I shared with you those myths this morning is, I would hope that you would examine which of those myths are you overtly or subtly perpetuating. You know, because myths and stereotypes have some truth in them. There's some grain of truth in all of those myths I told you about. And so it's easy to keep perpetuating them. The problem with the stereotype is that it takes a very small grain of truth and makes it seem like it's the whole picture. So I think that the sad thing is that these myths have been so perpetuated because I think they have kept many older people from living up to their potential and from being all that they could be. So you can at least stop these myths from being perpetuated in your pulpit and in your church, and that would certainly be a step forward. A third thing that I think we can do is to survey the congregation and the community to find the elderly. You would be amazed at the fact that the elderly are not terribly visible. I've heard of one pastor who was approached about the elderly in his congregation, and he said he didn't have very many, and when they did a survey, they found about 10% of the congregation was elderly. We're just not very aware of them. Also, we need to realize that if you do a survey and if you try to find out from the older people what their needs are, you might have a hard time doing it because older people are often very hesitant to ask for help because remaining independent is a very important need. One of the ways you can get around that is by interviewing the older people about the needs of the other elderly people in their community. And I'm not suggesting that you're manipulative because they are aware of the other needs and they're usually willing to tell you what they are even though they might not be willing to tell you what their own needs are. Okay, a fourth thing that I think we need to do is evaluate the messages that people are getting at church. And I have messages in quotes because I mean the subtle kind of thing. Not the words that you preach, but the way you act. What are you communicating to people by what happens in your church? For example, many churches emphasize programs for adolescents and for young people, but they don't have any outreach for older people. Now, I'm not suggesting that you give up the former, But I'm simply saying if you have strong programs for children and adolescents and young families and nothing beyond that, the subtle message is beyond that it's not important. Also, if you do have programs that are of particular interest to the elderly, when are they held? Are they held at night, usually? When night is the time when, because of decreased visual acuity, a lot of older people are hesitant to drive. Many older people have a problem with finding transportation. Not only that, but these are the very same people who usually have a lot of free time during the day. So if you offer programs of interest to elderly at night, are you really concerned about their needs? What about the accessibility of your church? Do older people have to climb steps to get there, push open heavy doors to get in? Once they are in the sanctuary, are they exposed to drafty floors or other ventilation problems? How accessible are your bathrooms? Last year when I taught a course in gerontology at Messiah, one of the requirements for that course was that each student had to go out and find an elder mentor, someone over 66 years of age with whom they could develop a friendship. And they weren't supposed to go and grill them and interview them. They were simply supposed to do 4 visits throughout the semester just on a basis of developing friendship. And do you know, the semester started in September. It was over in December, which meant I had figured it out so there would be 1 visit a month. That made good sense to my way of thinking. Suddenly it dawned on me about the end of October that about half the class hadn't even made the first visit yet. And so, you know, I did this typical teacher lecturing bit. What I found out was that most of the kids were scared to death to do it. But they finally got themselves out because part of their grade depended on it. And, you know, at the end of the semester, the input that I got from them on the evaluation was that was probably the most significant thing that happened all semester. One of the young men in that class, went to develop a friendship with a lady that he used to see at his church, whom he'd always appreciated, but he hadn't seen her there in the last couple years. And he and his wife went to visit her and just had really good times visiting her. And during the course of those visits, he learned that she was currently on medication that was causing a bladder problem for her and necessitated her getting to the bathroom very quickly at times. And in their church, the bathroom was at the bottom of a set of stairs. And so she didn't come to church because she did not want to be embarrassed by having an accident. Those are the kinds of things we don't usually think of. But that's what I mean by what are the subtle kinds of messages your church has given. David Moberg, I think, says it well when he says that most churches are quite willing to passively accept the participation of older people in the church affairs, but very few are willing to actively solicit the participation of elderly or those who are ill or handicapped or isolated. It's sort of like, if you want to come, okay, but we're not going to make an extra effort to ensure that you do or to ensure that we're meeting your needs when you do come. Okay, another thing that I think we can do is to involve the elderly in important roles. You know, senior power is not well organized, and part of this, I think, is due even in politics. The older are usually not a power block in voting, and I think part of it is due to the fact that older people are so diverse. About the only thing they have in common is their chronological age, and that's not very much at that point to hold you together. But oldsters can make a difference in their world by helping to change social conditions, only they often need help in getting mobilized to do it. You know, I think there are a number of churches who push older people out of positions of responsibility within the church when they reach a certain age. And, you know, in some churches, you're no longer qualified to hold an office after a certain age. I think that's unfortunate that we remove people from leadership roles at the very time when they have increased wisdom and understanding and also have more discretionary time available to use it. I think we need to find ways to keep older people meaningfully involved in the church. Another thing that I suspect is true is that often in evangelistic efforts, older people are overlooked. And I suspect that's partly due to the fact that, to the myth that older people are set in their ways and they're not going to change. But I would suggest to you that it is not unusual for older people, especially older people without a strong faith, to be searching for meaning in life, because as they face death, as they do a life review, again, the whole question of what is the meaning of life resurfaces. And so I think this is an area of wide outreach for Christians. And I think it's an area where older people themselves can best be used for that outreach. I don't think it's a kind of outreach that you're going to have where you have great evangelistic services and expect people to come into them. It's the kind of one-to-one outreach of evangelism that's important, and certainly an area that older people could get involved in. Another needy area that needs to be filled by older people in our churches is that of being grandparents for young children. Many families live far away from their extended family, and so they seldom get to be with their grandparents. But even for those who have grandparents, they can profit from having foster grandparents in the church. I think that because any young person is going to appreciate an older person taking interest in them, especially at the preschool and the school-age child. And you know what happens? If you form strong ties with that child during those school years, those ties can be particularly beneficial as that young person hits adolescence, when everybody in the world has more important things to say than their own parents. So I think older people can have a ministry to the younger people in the congregation. Okay, another way in which I think we can minister is by developing a holistic lifespan perspective. I believe that not only is it good, but it's also necessary to have special programs and activities for particular segments of your congregation, for the adolescents, for the young family, for the children. My plea is simply don't forget the end of the spectrum. Additionally, I would like to make one other plea. Don't make all the programs in your church age-segregated ones. I think we need to have more of an intergenerational emphasis as well, and we need to work on that. At that retirement village I was telling you about, not far from where I live, they have a very fascinating thing in that they have a daycare center for 3 and 4 and 5 year olds run by a professional staff. I think they have 2 or 3 teachers, but then staffed by the residents of that retirement village. Not only that, but each child in that daycare center has a special friend. And a special friend is one of the older people who's in the nursing section who can't get out of bed. And these young children go up once a day and take towels to them and talk to them. And it's a real ministry both ways. We need to find more ways of doing the intergenerational thing and getting the broad spectrum involved. Well, last of all, I'm going to tramp on your toes. Last of all, the important thing in ministry, and I suspect this is the place where it starts basically, is evaluate your own attitude toward aging. I suspect that one of the reasons that many of us have problems with older people is that we haven't come to grips with our own aging. And being around older people reminds us that we might get like that someday too. And that's scary if you haven't come to grips with what aging means. Attitudes communicate themselves very subtly but very loudly. We can control our behavior. And if we change our behavior, often attitude change follows. So I'm going to close by giving you 10 commandments for behavior, for your behavior toward the elderly. Before I do that, did I give you that cartoon? Yeah, before I do that, I'm going to show you this cartoon. I really like this. This man and lady are sitting around the table drinking coffee, and he says, if youth is so important, God would have given the 10 commandments to someone younger. And then the caption at the bottom, can we move it up just a bit? The caption at the very bottom says, if Moses had retired at 65, we'd all be in trouble. Well, I'm not yet 65, and I'm not Moses, but I'm going to share with you my commandments, okay? In terms of what you personally can do, 1, maintain regular contact. Do you know that even for pastors visiting older people who are chronically ill, they have 1 or 2 visits, and then the visits sort of drop off? Maintain regular contact. 2, include the older people in your celebrations. One of the things we as Christians really need to learn to do is to celebrate. We of all people in the world have reasons, but we do a poor job of it. 3, be imaginative in your gift giving. Perfume is a lot better than liniment. 4, listen thoughtfully to their reminiscences. The whole life review is important. Don't say, yes, you've told me that 3 times before. Listen to it and see what else you can learn from it. 5, don't gloss over their worries and or complaints. You know, I think the reason some older people complain so much is because it's the only way they have of getting attention. Find other ways of giving them their attention, but don't ignore what they're complaining about. 5, don't embarrass or distress them. Some older people really do want to have a hug and really do want to have someone to hold their hand. Other people don't. Don't demean them by calling them nicknames and things that embarrass them. 7, do not undermine their self-regard or their self-assurance. And what that means to me is, don't do for an older person things that they can do for themselves if you allow them enough time to do it. Pay them the compliment of being patient so that they can do what they are able to do. 8, be on their side. Let them know that you are for them, that you really do appreciate them. 9, be empathetic. And 10, don't forget to laugh. Remember that thou too, God granting, shall someday be old.